Our study continues in the fifth chapter of Judges. Last time we'd gotten through the 21st verse, and we're right in the midst of this Song of Deborah, and the portion of the song that is describing the victory the Israelites had over the king of the Canaanites. And the 22nd verse says, "Then were the horse hoofs broken by the means of the princings of their mighty ones." Now, remember, this army had 900 chariots of iron. And these chariots of iron were the one thing that, in the years past, had really held the Israelites off. They didn't even have any will to attack these chariots of iron, because the Israelites did not have iron. And they felt that they were an inferior army. They lost their faith in God, and consequently, God then was no longer with them. But now that Deborah has been raised up as a judge and a leader of the people, she's also a prophetess. Now they are being victorious, being led by Barak against this army of Jabin and Sisera, and consequently a description of that battle is given here. And the horse hoofs were broken. Now this was one of the ways that God used to help overthrow the army. Whenever the horse hoofs were broken, the horses would no longer be effective in the pulling of the chariots and the carrying of their mounted riders, and so this then would weaken the army. Exactly how the horses were broken, we don't know, except that he says, by the means of the princings of their mighty ones. So it seemed that something might have caused these horses to be made afraid. They were jumping and prancing around, and then this broke the horse hooves. Some have conjectured that verse 20 that talks about the stars and their courses fought against Sisera, that this could have somehow or other affected the weather and caused thunderings and lightnings and maybe rains and excited the horses, or even caused them to have a slippery ground and so they fell and injured themselves. But those are only conjectures. We do know, though, that something happened to the horses to make them lame. Then in verse 23, he says, "Curse you, Meroz, said the angel of the Lord, curse you bitterly, the inhabitants thereof." Now, nobody knows exactly where Meroz was. Evidently, it was a city that was close to this area of the fighting, a city that they greatly expected to have some volunteers to come and assist them in the battle. But evidently, Meroz did not produce anybody to help. Meroz held back. Meroz was derelict in their duty toward this cause of the nation of Israel. And so it is cursed. And it is cursed here, said the angel of the Lord, curse ye bitterly the inhabitants thereof. Now some say that the angel of the Lord represents our Savior, Jesus Christ. This I don't know. But we do know that when the angel of the Lord utters a bitter curse against the inhabitants of a place, that this is something to be taken very seriously. And that's the wording that's given here. Curse ye bitterly the inhabitants thereof, because they came not to help of the Lord, to help of the Lord against the mighty. Now, when we see that God's people are directed to do something, and they're fighting against odds that seem to be insurmountable, we cannot sit back and just say, well, let them do it. If God wants it to happen, He'll give them the victory. They don't need me. We are expected to lend our assistance to the cause. And that's what happened here in the case of Meroz. They came not to help of the Lord, to help this Israelite army to win this victory against the king of Canaan, would have been to have helped of the Lord. It's not just to help yourselves. When the Lord has a cause, we're helping the Lord, even though it is man's work that has to help carry this cause out. So we do have a bitter curse given against the inhabitants of Meroz for not coming to help. And he says to help against the mighty, indicating here again that the army that Sisera led was a mighty force. In verse 24, we have the beginning of the story and praise given to Jael for the part she played in this conquest, and certainly she did play a very important part. Blessed above women shall Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, be. Blessed shall she be above women in the tent. Now, this is a very high honor placed upon Jael. Jael was the wife of Heber, a descendant of the father-in-law of Moses, Jethro, and they were not really true Israelites in the sense of having their ancestors to be Israelites. Nevertheless, they were faithful to the nation and apparently faithful to the worship and duty to God. Now, she shall be blessed above women in the tent. This indicates that Jael was either of a low economic and social standing, or she was singled out as being peculiar because she didn't live in one of the cities but dwelt out in a tent. But she would be blessed above women in the tent. Of all women who dwelt in tents or who lived on her socioeconomic plane, she would be blessed above them. And just as surely then, as Miraz was to be cursed with a bitter curse, even so Jael was to be blessed. And then in verse 25, the narrative gives the story, some of the details of what happened. He asked water, and she gave him milk. She brought forth butter in a lordly dish. Now, as we know earlier, the story tells us that as Sisera was fleeing from the army of Barak, he had quit his chariot, and he was fleeing on foot. His other soldiers were either had been or were being rapidly put to death with the sword. He approached this tent of Jael, and Jael invited him to come in, and he came in for protection and for hiding, for rest. He no doubt was very weary and about run down. But in the course of her giving him this hospitality, she found opportunity to put him to death. So he asked water. He was thirsty. He wanted to drink. So she gave him milk to drink. And this further says here, she brought forth butter in a lordly dish. Now some of the translators say, well, this means milk that's had the butter taken out of it, so it would be what we call buttermilk. Other translators say, no, this is milk with the butter in it, so it would be what we call cream. Whether it was buttermilk, whether it was cream, whether it was butter and milk, the meaning is the same. And she brought forth this in a lordly dish. That is, she got the best dish, apparently, that she had. A dish that was reserved for only company. A lordly dish, and served him the very best. But while he was sleeping, as we know, she put him to death. And verse 26 tells how she did this. She put her hand to the nail, and her right hand to the workman's hammer, and with the hammer she smote Sisera. Now, this nail is described in earlier passage as being a tent nail, and so she put it to his temple, and then with the hammer she drove it right through. And this would have put him to death, of course. And the next phrase says, she smote off his head when she had pierced and stricken through his temples. Now, some interpret this to mean that she cut his head off, that she maybe took his sword and severed his head from the rest of his body. But it doesn't necessarily mean that she cut his head off. And some interpret this phrase, she smote off his head as she struck through his head. But the phrase does say, she smote off his head when she had pierced and stricken through his temples. So she took a tent nail while he was fast asleep. After he had been given hospitality, he was covered up with her mantle. He had been given the milk and the butter in a lordly dish. And so when he was at his very most vulnerable state, she struck him through the temple with his tent nail and the hammer and put him to death. And then in verse 27... we have the disgraceful end of Sisera. At her feet he bowed, he fell, he lay down. At her feet he bowed, he fell, or he bowed, there he fell down dead. Here we have the last moments of Sisera then, at the feet of a woman, at the feet of a woman in a tent, bowed down, at her mercy, and there he is put to death. Here's a man who has led a mighty army, a man who has been victorious for years over the Israelites, a man who had an army described as having 900 chariots of iron, a man who is a mighty man of war. He's used to taking the spoils of war. He's used to having the victory. He's used to being acclaimed as a great captain, as a genius out on the battlefield. Here he is, put to death at the hands of a woman. He falls down at the feet of a woman. And this shows then how when we're working against God, when we're not going according to what God wants us to do or wants to have done, how God can bring it about so that even if we're the most powerful and the most mighty among men, we can be brought down low. We can be defeated by weak things. We can be defeated by something that seems like it should even be no obstacle to us at all. And other circumstances in the normal course of Sisera's life and his military career, this woman would have presented no problem to him at all. There'd been no way that this woman could have even presented a threat to him in any way. But now, this is his end. This is the way he dies. This is the way his career, his life is finished, at the feet of a woman, and she then puts him to death. In verse 28, we have a description given of the expectations that the mother of Sisera had. She was expecting him to return back from the battle victorious, and she was looking for him. And so this song now switches over to her and shows the thoughts that she had. This would be shortly after the battle had finished, or maybe while the battle was still even raging. She was expecting Sisera to do as he had probably done so many times in the past, come home victorious. But now he was late coming home, and she was wondering what was detaining him. So the statement, "The mother of Sisera looked out at a window and cried through the lattice, 'Why is his chariot so long in coming? Why tarry the wheels of his chariots?'" Now, he was noted for having this army with 900 chariots of iron, with the great prancing horses. And so she was looking for his return. And she begins to ask the question, "Why is his chariot so long in coming? What's holding him up? He should be back by now. They should have had the victory and be home and the battle over with by this time. So what could possibly be holding him up? What could be causing the delay?" In verse 29, "Her wise ladies answered her." Now, the wise women who were there with Sisera's mother, Sisera, as you know, is the captain of this mighty army. They're no doubt used to living in high society among the Canaanites. So the wise ladies were there with her as she makes this inquiry, "What's keeping Sisera? Why is he not back any sooner?" She returned answer to herself. This is interpreted as the wisest of the ladies gave the answer back then to Sisera's mother. Verse 30, "Have they not sped? Have they not divided the prey?" Now, the answer is this. They have hurried. They have sped. They have been successful. And a victory as great as the one that they're surely to have just acquired is going to require some time. They have a prey here to divide. They have the spoils of war. They have overcome a great enemy. And so they're dividing the prey. And then she begins to describe what this prey might be. "To every man a damsel or two." Now this is, of course, a disgraceful thing for any army to be guilty of, but it is one of the facts that go along with warfare. The victorious armies come in and conquer, and then they have to themselves a damsel or two. They would be violating the women of the conquered army. And then they further say, "To Sisera, a prey of divers colors, a prey of divers colors of needlework." Now, Sisera would get some kind of a quilted garment that he could put around his neck, one that had many colors to it, made with needlework. No doubt would be robbed from some Israelite woman's wardrobe. and needlework on both sides, so that it would have had a lot of work done to it, very meticulously made, expensive, and is described here as being meat for the necks of them that take the spoil, something he could put around his neck, something he could wear and be so pleased with and so proud of. And so they're describing to Sisera's mother what's probably happening, what's probably causing the delay. They're being very victorious. Each soldier's got a maid or two. Sisera's going to have this needlework, this on both sides, and when he comes back, he'll probably give that to you. It'll be a token, a memento of this great victory. And they had great expectations for Sisera to come back victorious, but as we know, they would be most disappointed. Very shortly after this, we are sure that the army of Barak would then overtake them, and they'd be among those captives that Barak was told to lead captive. They'd be among those that would be completely overthrown as Israel conquered this Canaanite army. And so it's an interesting story given in this song of Deborah about those expecting Sisera to come home victorious, but yet they would be so disappointed. These are principles that apply to warfare in most any place it's conducted. Wherever there's been warfare on the face of this earth, we have seen similar to this. One army being victorious, one army being defeated. The defeated army having those at home who are expecting them to come back the victors, looking expectantly through the lattice work of the window, asking, why do they tarry, hoping maybe it's because they're just dividing the spoils of the victory. Yet, very shortly, they're going to learn the truth, and that is that Sisera has been utterly defeated and put to death. In the 83rd Psalm, we have a plea to God to destroy Israel's foes. And we have an interesting reference made in this passage to Sisera. So I'd like to read just a few verses from this 83rd Psalm. Beginning with the first verse, "Keep not thou silence, O God. Hold not thy peace, and be not still, O God. For lo, thine enemies make a tumult. They that hate thee have lifted up the head. They have taken crafty counsel against thy people and consulted against thy hidden ones. They have said, Come, let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. For they have consulted together with one consent. They are confederate against thee. The tabernacles of Edom and the Ishmaelites, of Moab and the Hagarines, Gebal and Ammon and Amalek, the Philistines with the inhabitants of Tyre. Asher also has joined with them. They have hope on the children of Lot, Shelah. Do unto them as unto the Midianites, as to Sisera, as to Jabin, at the brook of Kishon, which perished at Endor, they became as dung of the earth." And so the psalm goes on, but that's through the 10th verse. Just showing that this defeat of Sisera and his army is one of the great events that is referred to in that 83rd Psalm as being a plea to God to rise up against the enemies of Israel. So in the 31st verse, "Let all thine enemies perish, O Lord." Now it is the prayer here for the enemies of God to perish. It is proper, evidently, from this for God's people to pray against his enemies, to pray that he be victorious over these enemies, to pray that God's people be able to overcome, to be able to stand, be able to not be defeated by the enemies of God. But on the other hand, this prayer says, "But let them that love him be as the sun when he goeth forth in his might." Now it's also proper then to pray for the victory of God's people. Those that love him, those that are going to stand for him, let them be as the sun when he goeth forth in his might. And as we know, when the sun starts across the sky, there's no stopping of it. There's no way we can hinder it or slow it down. There's no way we can diminish it. It's there. Whether we want to believe it or not, whether we close our eyes and hide ourselves from it or not, it does not change the fact that the sun is there and it goes forth in his might. So the prayer is, let those that love God be like the sun that goeth forth in his might. They're not going to be deterred. They're not going to be stopped. They're going to be mighty. They're going to be victorious. And, of course, they're going to be seen. They will be available for those who want to know the truth to realize that they are there and they are carrying out the work of God. But the enemies, let them perish, O Lord. Let all thine enemies perish. So this is a proper prayer then for us to pray. The enemies of God should not be given the victory. They should not overcome. They should not reign over God's people. They should not be victorious over the things of God. And yet on the other hand, those that love Him should be given the victory. Now, to love Him means we're going to be carrying out His will, carrying out His commandments. And not like that city of Miraz that was to be cursed because they came not to help. Those that came not to help demonstrated they did not have love. They didn't love the Lord or the things of the Lord. Otherwise, they would have come to have helped. And the last phrase, and the land had rest 40 years. So after this victory by Deborah and Barak, and those 10,000 volunteers from Zebulun and Naphtali, and the other tribes that did help, after that victory, the land had rest 40 years. A nice period of time to have rest and peace and prosperity. No doubt Deborah reigned for this period of time. But we're going to find again that whenever the judge left Israel, that then the people are going to go back into their old ways. They're going to go back into sin. They would again leave God. And when they left God then, they were going to have the same consequences. They would lose this time of rest. They would lose this period of prosperity, and they would again then have to be punished by God for their sins. Well, that concludes the fifth chapter of Judges. We're going to conclude at that point. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying, goodbye, friends.